We are just 3 weeks away from the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. I thought we should start tonight with looking at one of the most courageous Christian martyrs in history, Perpetua, who was a martyr for the Christian faith in North Africa at the beginning of the 3rd century. Now, Perpetua was a Christian noblewoman who at the end of the 2nd century lived in Carthage, North Africa, what today would be Tunisia. And her Christian courage and steadfastness so impressed the famous theologian Augustine, who was claimed by all the reformers as a great inspiration for the sovereignty of God and their understanding of God's sovereignty and salvation. Augustine, who wrote City of God and who wrote Confessions. Augustine preached 4 sermons about Perpetua's witness for Christ. So she's obviously a majorly significant figure. When the Roman Emperor Septimius Severus determined to eradicate the vibrant Christian community in North Africa, Perpetua was amongst the very first to be arrested. From her diary, which she kept, and the diary of another prisoner, we have some insights as to her witness in prison. And by the way, she is considered the very first Christian authoress in history. It's the first woman that we have writings from, which was published, and therefore that makes her the first Christian authoress in history. Well, we have these diaries, and therefore there's a whole lot of things that are well recorded, and therefore we know more about her than we know of any other Christian woman victim of the Roman persecution. Her pagan father visited her and pleaded with her to deny that she was a Christian. And Perpetua responded that it was impossible that she be called anything than what I am, a Christian. Some days later, when her father again visited her, Perpetua was nursing her young son. And the father pleaded with her, "Have pity on my grey head. Have pity on me, your father. Do not abandon me to be the reproach of men. Think of your brothers, think of your mother and your aunt. Think of your child who will not be able to live once you are gone. Give up your pride." Perpetua remained steadfast. "It will all happen in a prisoner's dock as God wills. For you may be sure that we are not left ourselves, but all are in his power," she answered. On the day of her trial, Perpetua and her friends were marched before the governor, Hilarionus, and the friends of Perpetua were questioned first, and each of them readily admitted to being a Christian, and each refused to make any act of worship to the emperor, which would have set them free. As the governor turned to question Perpetua, her father, carrying Perpetua's arms, dramatically rushed to Perpetua and, grabbing hold of her arm, pleaded, "Perform the sacrifice. Have pity on your baby." And he used every kind of manipulation and emotional pressure on her. And the governor, Hilarionus, added, "Have pity on your father's grey head. Have pity on your infant son. Offer the sacrifice for the welfare of the emperor." And the response of Perpetua was straightforward: "I will not." "Are you a Christian then?" asked the governor. "Yes, I am," Perpetua responded decisively. The Roman governor then condemned Perpetua and her friends to die in the arena, not in the Colosseum in Rome, as this one is portrayed, but one similar to this in North Africa in Carthage. In fact, this is the very Colosseum where she was sacrificed, and there's even some markings Christians carved into the rocks in memory of Perpetua and her servant Felicitas. When Perpetua and her friends entered the stadium, they were dressed in belted tunics. And the amphitheatre was filled with nobles and ladies and senators and ambassadors and tens of thousands. And they shouted their insults and their derision as she was led to her death. And wild beasts and gladiators circled them on the arena floor, and the crowds in the stands roared, demanding to see blood. And by the way, at first, she would not show enough fear. She went joyfully and with such enthusiasm that they were so angry, they actually demanded that she be flogged first. And so all of the Christians were flogged first because they weren't showing fear. And they were coming in there with such joy and with such enthusiasm and excitement as though they were on the way to heaven, the people said. Well, the first thing they unleashed was a wild heifer who charged and tossed Perpetua into the air. And as she fell on her back, she sat up and adjusted her ripped tunic. In fact, the words of the people in the stands were that she was more concerned about her modesty than her pain. And then she walked over to help Felicitas, her servant. And then a starved leopard, which had been goaded, was let loose, but it wouldn't harm Perpetua. An impatient crowd began to scream for the death of the Christians. And Perpetua, Philistus, and their Christian friends were lined up, and one by one, they were slain by the gladiators. In fact, we have some of the reports from the people that in the stands, Perpetua actually encouraged the other Christians. You must all stand fast in the faith and not be weakened by what we have gone through. And Perpetua literally stood up and she said to the people, I am a Christian and I cannot deny Christ. And that also was heard throughout the arena. And the people in the stand said they went joyfully as though they were on the way to heaven. And the witnesses, yes, they were. And in fact, witnesses described Perpetua in the arena as young and beautiful, delicate, a pure and modest Christian lady. And they were absolutely shocked by this, and her testimony was repeated throughout the empire. And her stand, I am a Christian, and I cannot deny Christ, emboldened Christians throughout the Roman Empire. And Perpetua became the most famous Christian lady to die a martyr's death in the Roman Empire. An example of Christian resolve and courage, choosing to suffer and die with a clear conscience rather than to deny a Savior, inspired generations of Roman Christians to stand firm in the face of relentless persecution. And she was actually only 22 years old when she died in the arena. And this is a picture that was drawn at the time of angels receiving the souls of the slain in the arena, and of the lion standing back in awe, seeing the angels coming down. And this is the kind of pictures that people drew in order to depict what was going on. They said for every Christian who died in the arena, 10 were converted in the stands. And Tertullian wrote that famous description saying, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Jesus taught, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecute me, they will also persecute you. The scriptures clearly teach, yes, and all who desire to live a godly life in union with Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. All. Jesus said, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Jesus said, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. But I tell you, I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who after the killing of the body has power to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear God. The Apostle Peter wrote, in this you greatly rejoice. Though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold or silver, that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Suffering should drive us to depend upon God and to grow in our faith. Therefore, the scriptures exhort us to count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps. And Perpetua and her servant Philistus and her friends were some of those who did follow in his steps. And in their case, not tens, but hundreds came to Christ through their powerful testimony. Now, every year on the second Sunday of November is the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. This year, they believe that 300,000 congregations worldwide will observe Sunday the 9th of November or Sunday the 16th of November as International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. And Frontline Fellowship's part of it. In fact, if you go on, you click under Organizations, Frontline's got a webpage that we hire out on theirs every year as part of the sponsors for this International Day of Prayer, along with Voice of the Martyrs and Open Doors and other missions to the Persecuted Church. And of course, as we think of Persecuted Church this year, we've got to think of China, North Korea, Burma, Zimbabwe, most close to us. But as we are having the Reformation Day service at the Huguenot Monument, we remember the incredible courage of those persecuted Christians. The Huguenots were persecuted worse than almost any others. I think the Dutch and the French Protestants suffered the worst persecutions in all of Europe when it came to the 16th century persecutions. And so it's appropriate that we are so closely linked between the Reformation Day celebration and the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. And I think it also ties it together. It reminds us we're in a spiritual war. It reminds us of the enemies of the church. In fact, the enemies of the Reformation are the same people who are friends of the persecutors, if they aren't those persecutors themselves, anyway. So this is a wonderful opportunity for us to get involved in these sort of battles. Now, tonight, as we work our way through the Reformation overview, we're going to another great martyr of the faith, Jan Hus, who is the second of the great pre-reformers. But let me ask if there's any questions on Perpetua.
Yes, when I was in the book where all the scanning pictures were, it said that when they were lining up all the Christians to slit their throats or to kill them, Perpetua actually took the hand of the man who was holding the knife and put it to her own throat.
Because his hand was shaking so much, he couldn't do it properly. This gladiator was so terrified that she actually encouraged him, took his hand.
It was almost like such a gallant lady couldn't die except by her own will.
Yes, that's also what the people said.
Do you think, you know, like Ruth, her name maybe inspired that word ruthless? If Perpetua inspired Perpetual, you know, like.
Yes, in fact, her servant girl's name was Felicitas, which comes from the word faithfulness. And so in one of the sermons of Augustine, he actually spoke about perpetual faithfulness.
And then Hilarius.
Hilarianus, yes. Well, but this is the amazing thing, how they were so hostile. And by the way, there was also one quote here that I picked up, that Perpetua went with shining countenance and calm step as the beloved of God, as a bride of Christ, putting down everyone's stare by her own intense gaze. And as the mob screamed abuse, Perpetua was heard to say, "You have condemned us, but God will condemn you." She had courage, but she also wasn't a soppy, sentimental, soft, wishy-washy, "God loves you." Because she knew these people were in rebellion to God. Now, some of them came to repentance, and I'm sure she would have welcomed them as brethren in heaven, but the fact still is those who were rejoicing at the death of the Christians, as she said, "You have condemned us, but God will condemn you." Mm-hmm. That's just one of her last words. It's an amazing story, and such courage and such steadfastness. But as we are heading into the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church, I thought we could use this story in order to inspire more folks to observe it. Yes, Daniela?
What was her full name?
I don't know what her full name was. It's Perpetua. If we check in the Christian history publications, we'll maybe get her father's name. And I'm also sorry to say that the books actually say we do not know what happened to her husband. We don't know what happened to her child. There's no record of that. We just don't know. But
she was a Roman.
She was a Roman, even though she lived in North Africa in Carthage. She was not a Carthaginian, no.
People didn't have surnames in those days.
It tends to be Perpetua, son, or daughter of. Yes, they tended to use the first names more.
Yeah.
I mean, like Augustine. Mm-hmm. What's Augustine's second name? I'm not sure. I'm not sure what Patrick's second name is.
Yes.
Remember, Rome controlled the whole Mediterranean world on both sides of the Mediterranean. So this is, North Africa was white civilization controlled by the Romans. And before them, it was the Carthaginians, who were a European type of civilization. And the Visigoths went there as well. Now, of course, all of this became Christian in good time. But by the 7th century, the Muslim hordes came along and they annihilated the Christians over the next few centuries. And so, while millions of Christians remain to this day in Egypt by God's grace, but the Christians in what today is Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria were annihilated. They either fled or they died. So to think that the whole of North Africa was once fine Christian civilization, and it wasn't desert either. the northern parts, they had vineyards, they had wheat fields. But Islam seems to be a religion of the desert, and it brings the desert with it. And the Sahara Desert has been expanding ever since the Muslims took over North Africa. Just massive expansion of this desolation.
All these states are now Muslim, are they now under Muslim control?
Yes, they are. The only exception in North Africa is Egypt, where although it's got a Muslim government, you do have millions of Christians who survived. But they persecuted horribly. They still meet in caves in some places. There's one of the biggest churches in Egypt is actually meeting in a big cave. Massive underground cave.
But Carthage was a very high European civilization.
Yes.
The city of Carthage was the city which was sort of almost on the par with Rome and challenging Rome in power and splendor.
Which is why Rome wanted to destroy it so often.
Why Rome wanted to destroy it, yeah.
When this Destroy South Africa campaign was going on in Rhodesia, many pointed out the similarity with the Roman obsession with destroying Carthage, that it was similar. The destruction of white civilization in North Africa was almost a prefiguring of the obsession of destroying white civilization in Southern Africa later. And there is something of that. These are just some of the... here you can see some of the ruins in North Africa of what was obviously a magnificent civilization. These people built well, and this has survived who knows how many hordes and destructions and jihads and sandstorms, and yet you can still see they built magnificently to withstand centuries. In fact, millenniums speaks volumes of that. Well, we've got on our Reformation overview tonight also the presentation on Jan Hus. So before we go to Jan Hus and consider the film that they've got, let me look at one of the pre-reformers, John Hus, the reformer of Prague, and his motto was Truth Conquers. The Reformation movement that was launched by Wycliffe and his Lollards in England was intensely opposed and fiercely persecuted by the Roman Church. That was, of course, in the late 1300s. The Reformation movement was largely driven underground in the British Isles, but Wycliffe's teaching spread to Bohemia, where they resulted in dynamic revival. The two nations of England and Bohemia were linked in 1383 by the marriage of Anne of Bohemia to King Richard II of England, and then Bohemian students went to Oxford and English students went to Prague. And scriptural translations from the persecuted Waldensian refugees had also begun entering Bohemia in the 13th century. So when Anne of Bohemia married King Richard II, she sent copies of Wycliffe's writings and Bibles back to the homeland because she was a real believer. And Queen Anne's love for the Bible was shared by many of her countrymen. So soon, Conrad Stickner was preaching the gospel in the open air to large crowds. Matthew of Janov travelled throughout Bohemia preaching against the abuse of the church, and his followers were imprisoned and burned at the stake. And John Millick, archdeacon of the cathedral in Prague, preached fearlessly against the abuses of the church and wrote, "Antichrist has come," over the cardinal's doorway, and he was imprisoned for this graffiti. Born in the village of Husinec, Jan Hus studied for the priesthood and he received a master's degree in 1396. In 1402, he was appointed preacher in Bethlehem Chapel. And that's the house where he was actually born. And Jan Hus was appointed also the rector, a professor of Prague University, at age 34. And he also began to preach Reformation principles in a common language in the Chapel of Bethlehem in Prague. And this is the present form of the Chapel of Bethlehem in Prague. And Hus translated Wycliffe's works into the Bohemian language and exposed the superstitions, the fraudulent miracles, the sale of indulgences. And in 1405, Hus denounced the alleged appearances of Christ's blood on communion wafers as an elaborate hoax. And he condemned the sins of the clergy as fornicators, parasites, money misers, fat swine, drunks, gluttons. Sort of prefigures Martin Luther with the use of incendiary language to really expose the abuses of the Catholic clergy at that time. And he condemned the practice of simony, the buying of spiritual offices, and the taking of multiple paid positions without faithfully serving any. You could have people who were the bishop of this and coddle of that, and they weren't even there. They weren't doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And they were letting out some others to do it who had to pay them for the privilege of doing the work while he's collecting huge amounts of money. Just outrageous simony. And he described churches that sold indulgences as brothels. And Huss adopted Wycliffe's view of the church as an elect community with Christ, not the Pope, as its true head. And so Christ is the head of the church was a battle cry even in this day. And Huss's fiery sermons in the Bohemian language received enthusiastic, widespread support. Huss believed that pastors should be examples of God-fearing integrity. He preached vivid, accessible sermons which captured the people's imaginations. And Huss was described by supporters as a passionate reformer. On the walls of the chapel of Bethlehem were paintings contrasting the behavior of popes and Christ. The Pope rode on a horse. Christ walked barefoot. Jesus washed the disciples' feet, but the Pope prefers having his feet kissed. And so there's all these sort of contrasting type of pictures. Now let's get those pictures so we can incorporate them. Huss insists that no human institution, including the church, can be ultimate in authority, because only God has ultimate authority. In 1410, the Archbishop obtained from the Pope a ban on teachings in chapel, including specifically the Bethlehem Chapel. I mean, this was designed just to shut up Jan Hus. In that same year, the Archbishop burned over 200 volumes of Huss's works, of Wycliffe's works. And remember, this is before the printing press. So these are handwritten. This might have taken a year for some pious scribe to write down, and now they've just burned them. Basically, it was something like 2 years' wages for a copy of the Bible, for example, at that time. So you can imagine, to destroy 200 volumes before the advent of printing, it's just phenomenal destruction. Huss responded, "Fire does not consume truth. It is always the mark of a little mind that it vents its anger on inanimate objects." Huss responded by defending Wycliffe's orthodoxy. Huss was summoned to Rome, but he very wisely refused to go. What would have happened if he had? Archbishop Zbigniew then excommunicated Huss. Huss was actually excommunicated 5 times. You would have thought once would have done it, but they obviously kept wanting to do it again. And Huss was described as radical and dangerous. Huss then openly attacked the Pope's sales of indulgences in support of his war against Naples, and the Pope thereupon placed the whole city of Prague under a papal interdict. Now this meant that the entire city was placed under an ecclesiastical ban. All churches closed. No masses allowed. No confessions received. No marriages or burials allowed. Until this time, Huss had been protected by the emperor, by the nobility, by the university, from the wrath of the Pope. But with the entire city in turmoil, the reformer chose to rather go into exile. And during this time, Huss wrote On the Church, one of his greatest books. And you can see God's hands in this, that they actually, by banning him from the town, all they did was expand his ministry far wider, which it wouldn't have had the impact in the life of, for example, Martin Luther and others, if he hadn't been putting these thoughts into writing. And so he preached in the villages and countryside too. By the way, this is a statue of Jan Hus pointing to the Bible in the center of the university in Prague to this day. Very highly regarded. It shows when he was a professor at Charles University, he was really world-renowned for his learning and ability. At a general church council called at Constance in 1414 to heal the great schism, the multiple popes who all were infallible and all excommunicate one another and all wage war against one another, Huss lived during this great schism, and all these popes had bitterly anathetized one another, and so this Council of Constance was aimed to heal the schism, to bring an end to the schism, and they summoned Huss. You would have thought that the very purpose of this conference would have proved Huss's point, but they seem to be blind to that. But the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Sigismund, guaranteed Huss safe conduct in both directions, whatever the outcome of the case against him might be. However, upon arriving, Huss was imprisoned on the orders of the Pope, Pope John the 22nd. And despite the imperial guarantee of safe conduct, Huss was taken through the absolute mockery of a trial in which he is allowed absolutely no defense. Now, Huss had hoped to be able to present his views to the assembled authorities, but instead he found himself a victim of a cruel inquisition, which condemned him for heresies which he had neither believed nor taught, including that he claimed to be the fourth member of the Trinity. Mm-hmm. And unbelievable nonsense like this was part of the official charges. Huss prayed aloud that Christ might forgive his judges and his accusers. And this is the kind of mindless mockery that he was taken through. But he was steadfast to the end. Under pressure to recant, Huss declared, "I would not for a chapel full of gold recede from the truth. The truth stands, and it is mighty forever." Huss stated he would prefer to be burned in public than be silenced in private, in order that all Christendom might know that what I said was true in the end. On the 6th of July, 1415, Huss was condemned to death and taken to the outskirts of the city of Constance to be burned. His prayer was recorded. He prayed, "O most holy Christ, strengthen my spirit. Give me a fearless heart, a right faith, a firm hope, a perfect love, that for thy sake I may lay down my life with patience and joy." On arriving at the execution ground, Huss knelt and he prayed, "God is my witness that the evidence against me is false. I never thought nor preached except with the one intention of winning men, if possible, from their sins. In the truth of the gospel I've written, taught and preached, today I will gladly die." And so in 1415, Jan Hus was burned at the stake. And his trial and his abuses, you must remember, was what preceded the Great Reformation. And so when Martin Luther stood up to make his stand, he knew how Wycliffe had been condemned, how Jan Hus had been burned at the stake, and now you can imagine the courage that was needed to carry on when the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire and the Catholic Church had proven what they would do if you bucked the system and you persisted. Huss died singing, "Jesus, Son of the Living God, have mercy on me." And he was 43 years old at that time. And after Huss's martyrdom, his followers organized military resistance to the Holy Roman Empire. And remarkably, these vastly outnumbered Hussites repelled 6 crusades against him. Now here's a rebellious Hussite gathering. And notice the cup, the chalice. Because according to the Roman Church at that time, they only gave the wafer to the congregation. The clergy alone took the cup. So the cup was denied, because what if you spilt some of the blood of Christ? So only the clergy got the cup, and you just got the wafer. Open your mouth and then put the wafer in. It wouldn't even put it into the hand. It went straight into the mouth in case the person might drop it and so on. Well, the cup, the chalice, symbolized the Hussite rebellion, because he believed in administering the communion in both forms. And they fought under the motto, "Truth conquers." And here you can actually see, "Veritas venit." That's with the chalice, and that was the battle flag of the Hussites. And the Hussites were very innovative in warfare. They developed battle wagons, they developed wheeled defensive barriers, which they would take into battle, and then from behind they would be firing their muskets, or they would be firing the crossbows and the bows and arrows, and they would advance towards the enemy in this way. Sometimes they would take some of these wagons and fill them with burning hay and roll them down on the advancing Holy Roman Empire troops coming against them. And they 6 different crusades they beat back, and they showed that you could take on the Holy Roman Empire and survive. And as followers, the unity of the Brotherhood survived as an independent church, cooperating with the Waldensians and later with the Lutherans and the Calvinists. And the Hussites later became known as the Moravians. That's the way we came to know them. They even came to our shores, and Hanardendal has got the first mission station ever built in South Africa, and that was a Moravian mission station. Under Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf, the Moravians started a prayer chain that lasted 150 years. And during that extended prayer meeting, 2,400 Moravian missionaries were sent out throughout the world. Moravians were also instrumental in the conversion of John Wesley, you'll remember. One interesting anecdote is that Huss is accredited with making a prophecy at his death. "My goose is cooked," he said. Now, Huss is the Bohemian word for goose. "My goose is cooked, but 100 years from now, a swan will arise whose voice you will not be able to silence. And many saw Luther as that voice, hence the prevalence of swans in Lutheran art and architecture." And if you go into Reformation areas, you will see swans frequently.
Have you seen the swan on the church?
Yes, the German Lutheran Church on Strand Street, right. And the swans are always seen as part of it because the people understood this. 100 years from now, a swan will arise whose voice you'll not be able to silence. And 100 years after, Luther was making his stand. And so that's why swans and Luther have forever been associated. Many of the artworks I've seen in Europe, Luther's there next to a swan. Here at Lake Geneva, you've got the swans, of course. And Martin Luther was that swan who followed the example of Huss. What Huss had started in a small way, he turned into a worldwide movement. And his voice could not be silenced. In fact, Huss didn't have the printing press, but Luther mastered the printing press to the extent that half all the printed works in Europe at one time were Luther's works. And Farel, and Monet, and the whole of Geneva, and John Calvin, and all the reformers who followed after him, they were following after the courageous beginnings that were made by the Morning Star of the Reformation in England, John Wycliffe and Jan Hus of Bohemia, and they were the pre-reformers. And all the other reformers looked back to them in gratitude for the courage and example they made.
You know, just now you said there were 22 Pope Johns up to that point.
Yes.
Were there ever Pope Peters?
Never. There's never been a Pope Peter.
Strange, because Peter's supposed to have been on the rock.
I think it's considered that they can't name a Pope after the first. Who knows? But here you will see Jan Hus is marked. Top left, Jan Hus, just above Wycliffe, next to Melanchthon, Calvin, Gustavus Adolphus, Luther, Zwingli, and that would be William Tyndale. So those are some of the reformers, and so plainly you can see Hus having a key role amongst some of the 8 reformers that are on this postcard that I got from the Reformation Museum in Geneva. Well, we've got Truth Conquers Huss's testimony on the reformationsa.org website. I've even had people from overseas contacting and doing school plays on the basis of that article. And also it's a chapter, of course, in the Greatest Century Reformation book. Now, as we're looking at bringing about a new reformation, the resources we've got to inspire people to make use of at this time is the Greatest Century Reformation book with the testimonies, the stories, the biographies, and 16 great reformers are covered in different lengths with 180 pictures in this 220-page book on the Greatest Century Reformation. And then we need to revive our prayer life, and using Luther's writings in particular as a major foundation for it, and Andrew Murray's got the Power of Prayer Handbook to revive our devotional lives, and then reforming our family. So these are 3 books we work on that can get beginnings of Reformation. These are resources we didn't have when we started 3 years ago, but by God's grace we have now. And for society, going on into biblical principles for Africa. All of these are available in CDs, but now we've got the box sets, including the 12 box sets, which deal with different aspects of the Reformation with the PowerPoints. So all of that's available and usable as resources, which we hope we can promote a lot during this next Reformation celebration week. So whatever we can do to help promote and distribute and invite people, I think we've got an exciting lineup of speakers. We've got some good advertising options that have gone out. We've done more promotion by radio and by publications and mailings out than ever before. But still, the next week is key. So we've got 2 weeks to Reformation Day and just over a week to the Reformation Conference. Whatever we can distribute with leaflets or personal recommendations will go a long way. We'll keep sending out emails too. Mm-hmm. Any questions on Jan Hus?
No, I think your pictures are quite remarkable.
We scour the second-hand bookshops and so on.
I can see. I mean, what this is. This
was the most recent one found. Very rare picture. Just outside Constance. The treachery of the Roman Catholic Church and how they have dealt to these people. Interestingly enough, Pope John Paul II, before his death, did initiate a full investigation which absolved Jan Hus of heresy and rescinded the excommunication, and he has been reinstated, and the Catholic Church in the name of, well, Pope John Paul II, before he died, he apologized for the shameful treatment given, meted out to this brave and courageous Christian, Jan Hus. So they've recognized that they were at fault in the case of Jan Hus's execution. It is, but it's a very interesting point, because what was Hus's slogan? Truth conquers. Mm-hmm. And affects time. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought that 600 years later, just less than 600 years later, the Roman Catholic Church has had to admit, okay, we made a mistake. Mm-hmm. Sorry, we were wrong. Jan Hus is not anything we accused him of. He is an honorable man. And he wasn't guilty of any of the heresies we accused him of. Mm-hmm. So, in that sense, well, time has vindicated him in many ways. But to think that even the Catholic Church has had to acknowledge it, I think is very remarkable. Any other comments or questions?
Yeah, that if the emperor gave the promise that he would be protected on his way there and back, then, I mean, the emperor was clearly overruled by the Pope, which also says something.
That emperor, what a shame. And yet you compare that with, I think 100 years later, Martin Luther also gets a safe conduct to go to Worms to be dealt with there. But he knows, well, Hus also had a safe conduct, but it didn't do him any good. Mm-hmm. So Luther actually didn't expect to survive. Yeah. That's why he said Melanchthon mustn't come with him, because he wanted him to continue his work. So he went there with every expectation that they could betray him. But to think that Duke Frederick the Wise stood firm for him, where an emperor of the Holy Roman Empire had failed to stand up for his safe conduct for Luther. Mm-hmm. But Duke Frederick put all the pressure on Charles V to honour his commitment. Mm-hmm. And then he protected him for the rest of Luther's life against the outlaw ban, the call for, you know, Luther dead or alive. And he risked all kinds of excommunications and threats himself. But what a principled political leader, and how Emperor Sigismund could have gone down history as that principled, like Duke Frederick, who is loved to this day, for his courageous, principled, steadfast stand by Luther. It's a shameful thing when the prince does not stand by his people, as it was well said by Frederick the Wise, as Luther owes his prince allegiance, I owe him protection. And so he saw it's an exchange. And so I, as a prince, am answerable to God for protecting my people. He has not broken any laws. I owe him nothing but protection. And he stood by it despite all the threats, and to his honour. But what a shame for Emperor Sigismund in 1415. He missed the opportunity to go down in history as a great man, just as Pontius Pilate is disgraced by his name even being in the Apostles' Creed. How he, you know, Christ was crucified under Pontius Pilate. I mean, what a disgrace. He should have stood up and said, this man is innocent and I'll have nothing to do with this. But instead, okay, you can crucify him, but I'm washing my hands of the blood of this innocent man. What kind of magistrate is that?
I saw in the Bible, just a short while ago, actually, that it said that after that whole incident, Pontius Pilate, he and Herod, it says those words,
Yes, in fact, that's an important point that I wanted to bring out, and I intend to bring out next week when I meet with the political characters of Parliament, that the Herodians, the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Romans came together to crucify Christ. They united to crucify Christ. Can we not unite together to honour and lift up Christ's name? And so that's going to be one of our points, that we need to have as much love for Christ as the enemies have hatred for Christ. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, the big challenge. Will we be able to get
this
together?
Because that's about Christ, not about
Correct.
These Swiss cantons, these Swiss princes, they had virtually autonomous, and they, I mean, they could virtually say, okay, nobody...
Yes, but this was not actually... This is not actually Switzerland. This was part of the Holy Roman Empire, which at that... And actually, Switzerland was part of the Holy Roman Empire at that stage, too. Well, it all came unraveled during the Reformation time, when the princes started to stand for their faith instead of with the Pope. So this is a time of beginnings, but at that stage, nobody dared question the Pope, not in 1415.
Mm.
Of course, it's very different by Augsburg, even Worms, if you think that the princes were more on the side of Luther than they were on the side of the emperor. Brave men, and of course that's the difference. The princes stood with Luther in 1521, but they didn't seem to have that backbone at this stage. This is too early. But you need these forerunners, and while it looks like the people like Perpetua and Hus, martyrs of the church, like they failed, but they didn't fail. Because they succeeded in being a light in a dark, dark, dark time, which pointed to the future and helped give courage and steadfastness to the people who followed later. And you would have thought that the example of Hus might have intimidated Luther into silence, but actually it only inspired him into... They couldn't shut him up. He was determined to go forward, and he didn't think he'd survive, but he still was going to say, here I stand.
And yet, the massacre of the Huguenots in Paris didn't save
Paris. No, it did not. Because the church, but you've got to look at that also as a judgment on the country.
Mm.
Those Huguenots who left mightily blessed the people in Holland and Prussia and America and England and South Africa who came. But France was impoverished, and then the result of it, as we saw a couple of weeks ago with the French Revolution film, that was the consequence. They chased all the Protestants out of their country, and before they knew it, the atheists were doing to them what they had done to the Protestants. So it shows what you sow is what you reap. Well, let's get the lights off. I think let's try this, the second in the series.
I can understand your concern, but there is no